Well, good afternoon or good evening. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're delighted to have KT Nguyen with us here this afternoon discussing her brand new book called You Know What You Did. And she signed, KT signed a bunch of books for us. And sorry, KT, you're being upstaged
I'm
by
sorry.
a very, very cute
Here's
puppy.
The problem. If I don't hold him, he'll scratch the door down because he's waiting for his dad to come home and feed him.
Oh, he's so cute.
He is cute, but he's annoying. Anyway, start over, Patrick. My apologies.
No. And KT signed a batch of books for us. And as always, I'll go ahead and put a link in the comments field should you wish to purchase one. And if you have questions for KT or Barbara, go ahead and type them in, and I'll be back on screen whenever Barbara summons me towards the end of the hour. And I will be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Sorry about the canine thing, but we'll see how that goes. I'm very, very pleased to present to you a first novel that is meaningful on many layers. One of them is style, because I read first novels for the quality of the writing, probably more than anything else. So, and that judgment has held up really well over 34 years, going on 35. So I do congratulate our author on her prose. But there are lots of issues in this book, and I think it's difficult to write a compelling thriller where you're also dealing with various social issues, intergenerational trauma, the immigrant experience, mental illness, and so forth, and not let the issues override the story. But at the same time, you don't want to trivialize the issues by making them trivial. Right. So I guess a really good question would be to start with, how long did it take you to write this book? I mean, this is so complex. I don't think you just sat down one day and spun it off.
Well, I actually started writing it during COVID, which is probably something you are hearing from a lot of debut authors right now, because you're locked inside and it's just finally the chance to kind of get everything out on paper. So I started writing it just during the tail end of COVID.
I see. So I have been to Vietnam. I'm actually worrying. I'm not trying to be culturally appropriated here. I have a Chinese event at 7 for Chinese historical down at the bookstore. So I am. I can't remember if I bought this in Japan, China, or Vietnam.
Saigon. It looks like Japan, I think, but I'm no expert. It looks like Japan.
Right.
It's very pretty.
It is.
It actually matches my book cover.
Well, that's true. It does. I hadn't thought about that. All right. So if I lean back and you, now wait, let me do this. If you could see the tasteful green. In
yes.
This, see, there we go.
I caught a glimpse of that. So she coordinated with the book.
Right. Well, I was wrestling with the dog. But anyway, I have been to Vietnam. And certainly if you're there as a tourist, you have an opportunity to hear about the war from the Vietnam experience, not just the American. You know what really surprised me was going to the War Museum in Hanoi and recognizing that our war with Vietnam has a very small room. And in general, the museum is devoted to the ongoing centuries-old war with China. And that was a real surprise because it looms so large in our lives, as it clearly does in people who came here from Vietnam after the war. But for the Vietnamese, it didn't appear to be as significant.
Well, it's an older culture, and there are so many wars. My mother, for example, when she was a teenager, had the French colonial war. Right. The French were colonizers are there, so she would have soldiers going up and down the street. And to live through another war with the North and the South, and when the Vietnam War with America involved, it's just very traumatic. And so that's part of what is woven throughout my book, the idea of intergenerational trauma.
Absolutely. You have a horrendous opening scene where Annie, as you call her, her mother is, her mother is dead or dying, dead. And right from the beginning, then you wonder who Annie is, and did she actually kill her mother? Is she, is she crazy? And And I think you carry that all the way through. What is the mental illness that Annie is wrestling with, in addition to just the whole general mishmash of immigrant experience?
She has obsessive compulsive disorder. It's a very specific kind, contamination based. And actually, at any given time, 2 to 3 million adults in the US have obsessive compulsive disorder. And OCD is something with a lot of different forms. It manifests itself in a lot of different ways. In media, we hear about hand washing or a cleanliness, that sort of thing. But it's often treated really lightly. TV shows like Monk, you know, there it's often treated very lightly. But the portrayal in my book, I think, is a for many people more realistic. It's a very dark portrayal because OCD can make you feel like a prisoner to your own thoughts and a prisoner in your own body.
Does it? I mean, obviously it's not something I've personally experienced with. I've known a couple of people. My husband has a touch of it, although in his case, it may just be stubbornness. Quite determinate, but right. But nonetheless, it is fascinating, I think, for readers when when the character has an interior life that you were able to actually make exterior by writing it. And so our problem with Annie all the way through the book is we really don't know how much she has come to grips with what's going on, how much she understands what's going on, whether the things she's afraid of or the things that are happening are real, or whether, they're filtered through her OCD and therefore may not be exactly what we think. So I don't know that I would really call her an unreliable narrator in the sense she's not deliberately making things false. She's not actually lying to us.
She's almost the ultimate unreliable narrator in a way because she isn't lying, but you can't trust anything she's saying necessarily.
Yeah,
even she
true.
Can't trust herself.
Yeah. Well, I know. Yeah, that's definitely true. Maybe there's sort of two classes of the unreliable narrator. One, the deliberate one. Like going all the way back to Roger Ackroyd or somebody. Mm. And then maybe there's the one, as you say, who really can't distinguish truth from fiction on their own. Do you have any personal experience with this, or do you know anybody that has OCD? Because how else did you portray it so well?
I do. I actually have OCD and I've managed it for many, many years. Beautifully with medication, because in my case, I think there's a strong genetic component. My mother has it, I have relatives who have it, I have it. And so because it's biochemical, in my case, it's easier to treat. It's similar to the character in the book. I take one pill every day and it manages the intrusive thoughts. Totally changed my life. I got diagnosed in my early 30s. Mm-hmm. I went to the Berkeley Therapy Institute, which is a great place for anxiety disorders, and it changed my life. Because as I said, in media, you see this one view of OCD, and I had no idea I had it. I'm not particularly organized. I don't wash. I'm not particularly cleanly with my, washing everything, but OCD has many different forms. And that's something I learned. And hopefully by reading the book, other people will see themselves or be able to experience what it's like to have this sort of mental health concern. And I think putting yourself in that situation breeds empathy, which I think is a good thing.
So you had to really reach deep inside yourself. Was there anything you learned about yourself while writing this book?
I think I learned that my mental health is stronger than I think it is. Because going back and reconnecting with all those intrusive thoughts and those feelings to really portray Annie's experience in a raw and visceral way, you'd think it could trigger the condition again, but it didn't.
Well, that speaks very well for the control that you have. I know there's a scene in the book where she can't remember if she took her pill.
Yeah.
And, that's really distressing to her because she... in the situation she's in, she can't decide whether it's because she didn't take her pill, which she can't remember, or whether it's something actually happening.
I think that's part of OCD as well. It's nicknamed the doubting disorder.
Is
because
it?
you Yes, because you have such self-doubt. You wonder, you question yourself constantly. And it goes back to the unreliable narrator aspect because you wonder, did I wash that? Did I wash my hands? Did I touch that? Did I brush against that? And you begin to doubt your own movements in the physical world. And in very extreme cases, there can be a dissociative element where you just, like Annie, you don't know if you did something. You just question yourself, and there's that ferocious cycle of thoughts going through your head, and you begin to doubt yourself, and you wonder, did I do this?
So she has a teenage daughter. Is there any concern if this has got a genetic component that perhaps her daughter, who she's really ferocious in protecting her daughter, which has a lot to do with how this story plays out. Is that something she's thinking about at all, Dee, or would it be something she'd try to deny?
I'm sure she would be watching out for it. I think the interesting thing in the book is kind of unintended legacies we leave for our children. Her mother carried the burdens of war, and a lot of that stress and mental disturbance transferred to Annie. And as much as she tries not to pass it on to her daughter, Tabby, we see throughout the story that Tabby does pick up some of it.
Well, yeah, and especially when trauma is part of it, they all are suffering trauma. So the mother, I'm assuming, I'm trying to remember because honestly, it's been a while since I read the book. Her mom is a war refugee, came to America from whatever Saigon or whatever the airlift was. And as she ages, she kind of disintegrates, doesn't she? When we finally, well, we meet her briefly, at the very beginning of the book, but it appears that her living situation has greatly deteriorated. Is that partly from OCD and mostly from the war?
Hoarding is one form that OCD can take. Extreme hoarding is a form of OCD. It's a form of trying to control your surroundings. And also, research has shown that people with certain forms of OCD can be more susceptible to PTSD. So it's kind of a double whammy there. She has
Okay.
PTSD from the war, and though you can try to, part of the story is also about appearances. Annie appears to have the perfect life, the perfect husband, which is a trope you see in domestic suspense and thrillers frequently. So everything appears perfect on the surface, and even her mother might be able to seem fine for many years, but below the surface, there is that disturbance, that trauma, and it resurfaces.
Right. So when we come across her at the very beginning, with Annie, we see that the mom is living in a pretty desperate situation, sleeping on a mat, not particularly clean, et cetera. And Annie, I'm not sure looking back whether Annie wonders how her mother died, whether she had anything to do with it or does she just come upon her mother? I can't honestly recall.
I don't want to give anything away,
Well,
Barbara. That's part
okay.
of
Well,
the
so Annie, there's Annie with her mother, her dead
Yes.
mother, who she has cremated. Her mom doesn't, according to Annie anyway, her mother would not have liked an American style funeral. And so right away, that causes some trauma with Annie's daughter, Tabby, who doesn't think that this is a very loving or respectful way to wish her grandmother off. And so there's tension, right there from the beginning. And I guess that's a harbinger of the fact that maybe this perfect life isn't quite as perfect as it appears. So Annie's husband is a journalist, right? And he's done extremely well.
Yes, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he was embedded in the Afghan War. He's going off on assignment to Syria. He's very accomplished, and he dotes on Annie
And how
and
did,
his daughter.
right, how did he meet Annie? Because I think that comes along in the book, or is that going to be any kind of a spoiler?
It's not a spoiler. He meets Annie. She's with a couple of friends of hers at university, and she feels very out of place, and he comes to her rescue. So they meet when he comes as the knight in shining armor, and that plays throughout their marriage as well, where he takes care of her and takes care of the family and takes care of everything.
And in fact, when she was a student, now that I, you see, I'm slightly fragmented here because I think I read this book about 4 or 5 months ago when I picked it out for our first mystery club. This is our April first.
I'm so honored you read it. I didn't know that you actually read the books so carefully and that you, I'm so honored.
I read all of our event books, but I read all of our book club picks, our monthly book club picks. And when I read this early on, I knew it was going to be our April first mystery pick because, you know, as I said before, I always read for the quality of the prose, but I do like to give people who signed up to belong to one of our subscription clubs a chance to read different things. I don't want to give them the same book, you know, month after month. And there tend to be waves of things that publish, you know, there tend to be like clusters of things. Yeah. So I have to work, you know, to find books that are not just like the books before. And very, that means the club members aren't necessarily going to like every book I pick, yes, right? Because people tend to read and, you know, not everybody reads broadly. Some people read in more defined channels, but that's part of my goal. So when I read,
I appreciate that so much because it's so hard now because people are so niche and they read so narrowly. And I'm guilty of it sometimes myself where I just, end of the day, you're tired. I know what I like. I like psychological thrillers, domestic suspense, and I will read, you know, 1, 2, 3 of them a week. Like I just gobble them up and it's satisfying. But another thing I do like is books that are a little weird and offbeat. And so when I find them, I really treasure that. And right. I'm really grateful that you did select the book and you try to find books that are a little different.
Well, I do. I mean, you know, sometimes it's a spy story. I was really proud of myself. Most of the award books up for from 2023 are all books that were part of our first mystery club book.
At the Lefty Awards.
Alana Peacock and her wonderful spy story. And
it's,
you know,
so beautiful. Her story is so beautiful. I loved that one.
Me too. I mean, you know, there were so many. So, you know, it's nice to try to pull from several genres. We had a gothic, we had a spy story, you know, we had a military fiction thing. And I think the people that sign up for these clubs and stick with them are doing it in part because they too want to read different kinds of books. You know, they don't want, we have specific clubs, like there's a cozy club or a British crime club or a hard-boiled club. And that's for people who do want to stay in niche. You know, and those work really well too. But I always enjoy the first mystery club. And it's like a little test at the end of the year when I see books that come onto best lists or recommended. I think, how did I do? Usually pretty well. All things considered. And again, I like to think that judges are, you know, however books are impaneled for selection, also read for prose. That no matter how clever the book is, if it's poorly written, then, you know, it doesn't really grab. Now, your book has, I'll read The Moth. This will give you an idea. And I didn't know this when I picked the book, but now I do. All right, most anticipated crime fiction of 2024 from Crime Reads, Spring 24 Preview Mysteries and Thrillers Top 10 from Publishers Weekly, Publishers Marketplace Buzz Book, Reader's Most Anticipated Mystery and Thriller on Goodreads, BookBub, trying to think, Novel Suspects, 18 Most Anticipated Books of 2024 from Biblio Lifestyle, and so forth, Elle Magazine. Now you have experience in magazines, so I guess I'm not terribly surprised that several magazines read your book.
Oh, my experience in magazines is ancient, but still, it was in my 20s. I was a magazine editor at Glamour Magazine and a couple other magazines in New York. And I think that's where I started learning about interviewing people and crafting a story. And a lot of hopefully what shines through in my book is the character aspect, because you're telling when you're interviewing people, like I was interviewing people for Glamour, you're bringing out that character, that person's story, and you're creating that narrative. And I think that's one aspect that I feel like I did well in the book, but there are other aspects that maybe the next book, I feel like I've learned so much and I'll, you know, improve on, but
Ideally, you know, you learn from every book and get better with every book, but not every
Have you found that with writers that you've known you discovered early? Have you found their books improve?
Not, you know, it's so hard to say. Sometimes some writers only have one really good idea. And, you know, no matter how great it is, I don't mean that to discourage you because I don't think that's the case with you, but there have been debut novels that have been very impactful, but the author then has never really come up with a story that worked as well for them. You know, some stories cry out to be told. I did the guest of honor interview at Left Coast Crime on Saturday for Robert Jigoni. Robert Jigoni is a person who can find a story walking around the block. I mean, you know, everywhere he goes, everything he does is a story. He knows how to do that. He was a lawyer before and so forth. Other people really have to labor, you know, to come up with inspiration or a story. All creative minds are not equal. They just aren't. So sometimes it's very hard for a person to write, you know, consistently. Sometimes people never write another book. You just don't know. And sometimes life intervenes. People get sick or, you know, things happen. So there's no sure bet. But most of the time, I have found that people who do well with their first novel are inspired to try again. And you know, they've learned something, and hopefully they found a story that speaks equally to them. If you're writing a series, you make it easier in some respects. If you're not writing a series, you have more freedom because you get to start all over again and do world building and find new characters, and you don't have to fit them into what you already wrote. So, you know, there are two schools of thought there. And sometimes series writers decide to break out and write a standalone. And sometimes people who have written standalones decide to write a series. I tell people all the time that Rex Stout wrote 49 novels before he ever thought about Nero Wolfe.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I mean,
he had the Native American series, right? I don't know. What did he really?
Mm-hmm. He really did. You know, there are absolutely no rules for this. You just, you know, have to trust in yourself. Now, let me read a few comments that other people have made about this book. One says, with unflinching determination, you keep readers pinned to the page of this dark, devastating psychological horror. That's not really how I would describe this book. In this harrowing thriller, the main character has an increasingly fractured mind, leading to dizzying twists. Now that I do think is true, that we have to allow for her mind fracturing. Publishers Weekly says, braiding together hair-raising psychological suspense and poignant study of war's intergenerational trauma. Sorry, I missed the part where we pronounced your name.
Oh, it's Wen.
Thank you. It adds depth to the familiar setup of the unreliable, mentally ill heroine. Lisa Unger and Tess Gerritsen fans take note. And it's interesting to me as I read through this, the other authors that different reviewers compare you to. And they're not, it's not like a one-note thing, you know, where it's always the same author, which I think says a lot about how people read and react, you know, to other authors. You know, one will pull you in. And I think this one's really nice. The description of Annie's OCD and her struggles to control it are particularly visceral. An exploration of generational trauma and mental illness. There is healing to be had in the journey and the ending. And I suspect you really like that because that's one of the things you were hoping to accomplish in writing this.
I do. I mean, one of the things I'm most proud of in the reception of the book is whether or not people like the book, which thankfully most people do, but even if they didn't, and I do read Goodreads reviews. I know I'm not supposed to, but I do.
Oh. Or Amazon. No.
I can't help it. And so, but people resoundingly appreciate the handling of OCD and mental health in the book and that it's done in a compelling way that gives insight into the condition without being, you know, sensational.
Right. Well, and the thriller aspect, which I mentioned, that I think is very difficult to talk about these serious issues while not losing the propulsion of a thriller. I like somebody said here, with themes of identity, guilt, mental illness, and fragmenting reality, which I think is a really great description, you never quite know who or what to believe. Right till the end, I kept changing my mind about how all the intriguing pieces of this disturbing puzzle might resolve. So I thought Helen Cooper, that's a very insightful review.
A lot of the books that I love to read and that I was reading when I wrote this are from contemporary British and Canadian and Australian psychological thriller authors. And those tend to be a little more character driven and less plot driven than US thriller authors. And I think that's reflected in the book a bit.
Yeah, I don't know that I would go quite that far, but yes, I do think that, I mean, I've never been entirely sure what literary fiction is as compared to other fiction, you know, or the description of literary mystery. What does that actually mean? Does it mean it just has less plot? I mean, does it have more characters and it's
longer words, Barbara?
Yeah, what is it? But I definitely think that, you know, your book is character driven. Yeah. You know, all of the action arises out of the characters. There's no extrinsic force here. There's not an invasion. There's not a serial killer. There's not, you know, something. Everything that happens arises from the emotional and mental acuities or deficits of these people.
I'm curious what you think of this description that I've been using. I think it's a combination of The Shining and Celeste Ng. So a little bit of slow descent into madness and Asian American family drama, domestic suspense mixed together.
Well, you know, and that's a really interesting point. There's such a huge emphasis on Black American family drama and all that. There's less perhaps written at the moment about the Asian American. And, you know, Lisa C and I have been friends. I've walked her entire career with Lisa, and she, you know, she's writing historical fiction, but some of it comes up very close. So
there really aren't Asian, a lot of, I think Celeste Ng, some of her books are kind of characterized as thrillers, like Everything I Never Told
right.
You, Little Fires Everywhere. Some people consider Yellowface to be a thriller. So it's a little bit not really.
Right. Well, you know, when you, I don't think that we need to put labels on books. I really don't like that. At the store, we don't do that. You know, I've been many bookstores where they'll have them all,
yeah,
you know, say, we don't do that. We have this big file called fiction. But if you think about it, our bestsellers for years were Clive Cussler and still are Diana Gabaldon, and neither one of them fits into any category, you know. So we find it works better. We do separate out the hard sci-fi and the really romantic, but beyond that, you know, and the poetry, but beyond that, we just call it fiction. And I wish that there were, and a lot of this is because internet book selling, and there's a whole thing about approved labels and so forth, or tags that you have to put on things. And I'm anti that, you know.
Oh, that's great.
I really like books that don't classify easily. And
there's a freedom to that, which I wish readers, that people would appreciate, because it brings back the freedom of when you just walk into a library and browse the fiction section.
Fiction.
You didn't know what you were going to get. It wasn't like you had read 400 reviews on the author already. It
That's
was a surprise.
Well, we are seeing more, you know, we're seeing more Latina voices. We are seeing more Asian voices. But, you know, Asia is a huge place with varying countries and varying voices. So, you know, you can't really just say, equate the Chinese with the Burmese, with the Vietnamese, you know, with the Thai. Everybody has their own set of things we've been talking about, you know, their own history, their own trauma, their own, most of it probably has some colonial tinge, whatever. And so the other thing that's working to bring us more of that, you're writing in English, but a lot of the books that we need to have access to have to be translated. So there's a wave of the Japanese have always been wild about crime fiction.
Like, I mean, butter.
We have a lot of Japanese customers that we, you know, that we ship to. But now increasingly I'm seeing books translated from Japanese, you know, coming into the country. And, you know, there's not very many authors from India, but some. And certainly
British Indian,
Yeah, you know, so I think that part of it is that we're just less familiar with some of the Asian voices than we are with the others. I found last year to be really fascinating in the number. Have you run across Grace Lee yet?
I share an editor with her at Dutton, but no, I've never met her. But her book is wonderful.
She's still, I think, in medical school at my alma mater. At Stanford, and I keep trying to get her over here. But in any case, her characters were Asian, they were Chinese, but they were really engaged in an art heist.
Yes.
So it was less about being, it was very little about being, you know, the experience of being immigrants, although some, and they weren't even necessarily immigrants, but
they're very young.
Her characters. Very young, and their motivation was political. You know, so, and then, you know, you have somebody like Kevin Kwan in Crazy Rich Asians, which is an entirely different experience, you know, highlighting. So I think it's great that your book, I think, has a different focus and on a different community. And I mean, it was the immigrant experience, which is such a big thing right now, you know, trying every country, not just the US, but countries all over are trying to figure out, you know, what to do about immigrants who want to come and live there. Climate change, economics, war, you know, famine, so many different things.
And I think that what's interesting is, you may not be a Vietnam War refugee, but there are so many refugees and people displaced from other wars. And as you said, traveling to other countries, trying to find a new home. And I think the book touches upon how that's very destabilizing. It can be, you know, disturbing, and how that ripples through generations.
Absolutely. I think displacement is a very traumatizing thing. I had an author, because when we had Poison Pen Press, for 20 years and all, I edited a lot of very interesting books. And one of them, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but there's a mountain, a Vietnamese mountain community. I can't think what they're called. Is it the Hmong?
There are Hmong, yeah.
Yeah, and a group of them settled in North Carolina. Really good setting. And North Carolina, there go the dogs. I knew this was going to happen.
I can't
one
hear them.
Second. Well, I can hear them and they're really annoying. So 1 second while I close the door. Well, it's dinner time. Oh. But anyway, what was interesting to me is that when the Scots were displaced from the Highlands after the Battle of Culloden, and many of them chose to immigrate because, you know, their communities were destroyed in the aftermath of the bid for Bonnie Prince Charlie. And a great many of them went to Canada, Nova Scotia, and so forth. But a lot of them came to North Carolina because the mountains and so forth were similar to home. And, you know, that's where we get moonshine and we get quilting and we get ballads. And we get all these things from the Scots. And what I thought was so interesting is that the Hmong was the same thing, right? Because they lived in a mountainous part of Vietnam. I mean, I've traveled there and, you know, I didn't go up into the mountains, but certainly could see them. And so they too felt at home in North Carolina and brought a different culture, but it was still... Geography has so much to do, I think, with how people feel, if they are displaced, how they feel kind of connected, you know, to something.
I think you're just so hungry for that piece of home and for something that you can cling to. So beautiful mountains, whether it's the taste of a familiar food, you know, it's just something people are so desperate to have that familiarity.
Yeah, well, absolutely true. That's why the Welsh went to West Virginia, because, you know, they were big into mining. I mean, you know,
yeah.
It is. No, you know, yeah. You can look around. You know, yeah. The Germans went to Furman, Wisconsin, and the Finns went to Friesen, Minnesota. Yeah. You know, if you really look at it, there we are. But let's talk about, we've talked about Annie, and we've mentioned Tabby, the teenage daughter, and her mother, we find dead at the very beginning. But what we haven't talked about are another person who dies, and we haven't talked about Annie's husband, other than to mention he's a journalist. So what should we say?
There's a rich art patron who comes on very early in the story named Bertie, and she's Annie's main benefactor, and she goes missing. So that's one of the earliest
when you
crimes.
Say main benefactor, back up and tell us that Annie is an artist.
Annie is an artist, and she is a painter, and she's been painting, doing commissions for Bertie Fenton for years and years, and she's wealthy art patron, funny character. She drinks moonshine in the story, and she goes missing, and the police investigation zeroes in on Annie. Unfortunately, it's at a point where she is at a low and her OCD is flaring up, and she's doubting herself, and her intrusive thoughts are taking over. And I think that's all I want to say without giving any spoilers away.
Sure. And also there was some tension created in Annie's marriage because a magazine, I'm trying to remember what it was called, Southern Her. anyway, wants to do a feature about yes. Annie as an artist. And that means that Annie, in her own right, you know, is becoming recognized, maybe can earn her own money, you know, has an identity outside her family, all of which can be very destabilizing in a family situation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's Annie's career is starting to potentially take off, and that could bring changes in their household.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, if you have one star in a household, I think this is always why you can now hear them. Why, you know, Hollywood marriages tend to be, or, you know, performers' marriages, or even two writers together. It's hard to have two stars in one family. You know, it almost works out that one's the support person and the other is the, you know, the lead character. And some people make it work. You know, there are musicians and actors and other things who have very successful marriages. But it takes a lot, I think, for two people kind of used to the limelight or wanting recognition to make space for the other one.
Yeah, and I think we get, in marriages, we can fall into familiar roles where the role play with each other, you expect something from the other person. And then if one person changes, it's like, oh, what's going on here? You're not the same person anymore. So part of the story that You Know What You Did is also about how well we know people that are closest to us,
mm-hmm.
which is common absolutely. In a lot of domestic suspense stories, but it's interesting.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, most families, I mean, there's shared resources, and where do the resources come from? And when the balance of that begins to change, when either some resources melt away, let's say somebody made a bad financial decision or, you know, whatever, or divorce enters in and fractures a household in resources, or conversely, when somebody starts bringing in more money or different things, then again, that can be very destabilizing to a group dynamic when this is established. So, you know, conflict is that thing that drives thrillers. So it's always
it
good.
It is, exactly. That's why I love domestic suspense, because it goes behind the doors, within the walls of homes that seem completely perfect, neighborhoods that seem perfect, and you see what's really going on inside. So it's the nosy aspect of me.
Interesting thought. Do you like spy fiction? Because I think spy fiction does similar things.
I like Jean Le Carré, and I liked the I.S. Barrie, The Peacock and the Sparrow, because It wasn't the typical espionage thriller. It was actually beautifully written. The descriptions of place. I just found it to be kind of like a modern classic. It wasn't really like the, you know,
Oh, good. Well, then I can recommend another author to you called Joseph Cannon. He did my interview. We did the whole thing together, and he has a new book coming out called Shanghai. But he is a really brilliant. But you would like his books very much.
Okay.
So he won an Edgar for his first book called Los Alamos, and I think in many ways his best book is called Istanbul Passage. So
Okay.
I recommend it. You can watch me talk to him in June, or you can actually go to our YouTube or Facebook, and you can find I.S. Barrie and Joseph Cannon and me talking.
Oh, okay.
It'll be
Great.
listed under I.S. Barrie from last, I think it was July or August, pretty sure.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a wonderful conversation, but I agree with you. I like spy stories that are rich in character and, but also, even then, you often don't know who to trust all the way through the spy story. That's another big issue is, destabilizing and lack of trust and so forth. They're not that different than domestic suspense, a lot of them.
That's interesting. That's an interesting view. You've read every single book in the genre, pretty much, Barbara. What would you say is closest to You Know What You Did, my book?
Well, I don't want to make a comparison because the minute I do, I start narrowing the field of readers.
Oh.
If I mention somebody, maybe somebody didn't care for their books, then they might not read yours. That's a very chancy thing. I never do my own best list. I mean, at the end of the year, a lot of my staff, they like to put up there. I don't dare do that. It would be really, really ugly. I think, I think your book is very hard to classify. I regarded it as, I can't say unique because unique is only one thing, and I never use qualifiers with unique. It drives my husband would pour water on me if I said very unique or nearly unique or almost unique, and I'll no qualifiers for unique. It's either is or it isn't. But it's a very special read, and I do think that the Vietnam War, is so trauma. I'm a Vietnam War widow, so it's a very traumatizing
Oh,
thing.
I didn't know that.
Well, why would you? But I think for many Americans, it's hard to see the other side. It's really difficult. Our own losses, our own, it fractured our country in terrible ways. And I think it's very helpful for people, especially now that there's some distance, for maybe the children of people who were fought in the war and all to see the other side, to see a different experience and recognize that, people came back with PTSD, people came back with drug habits, marriages broke, families divided, to see that it was the same, it was the same on the other side.
And I think right when you read a lot of historical fiction from a Vietnamese perspective, or you read stories in the news, they're usually really life-affirming stories about coming to a dream country, stories of hope, which is wonderful, but you have to look at the reality of it as well. American soldiers came back. Refugees came here and they had the same PTSD, as you're saying, the same trauma. And they were in the same battlefields. My mother would, she still knows what the smell of burning flesh is, in pits. We were lucky, my family, to come over very early, earlier than the characters in my story, in 1975, like one of the first groups to come
Right.
over, but right before the fall of Saigon. But the things she's witnessed, you can't go through that without having it affect you.
Of course not. And then there are all the children that were born of, mixed marriages and not sure whether who they belong to. They have a foot in either culture. Some of them were left behind. Some of them came to the United States. I think in their case, trying to establish their identity. It can also be a mixed race thing. It could have been, a Black American soldier or different, I think the children of those kinds of relationships. I mean, it's certainly true in Europe. There are all kinds of stories about, French and German, or whatever it is. And then there's rape. There's so many different issues that come in. We're going to see it all. We're seeing it all over again right now, with looking at the Ukraine and all. So I do think that the things that you write about are, you know, are so relevant. Trying to, you know, we all have to think about. I'm hoping that it brings more compassion to readers, you know, when they see how this has worked out. But anyway, getting back to the basic thriller thing, we start with a dead body and then somebody disappears and we're not sure how the family's going to hold up and it's fracturing and we don't know if our principal character, Annie, we don't know whether she, you know, how reliable she is about telling us what happened and whether she's actually killed anybody. So, you know, there we are. It's a really interesting story. So Patrick, come and join us and see whether we have any questions. We probably stunned the audience and they won't say anything. Which often happens. That's okay.
Stun the audience. Let's see here. Well, actually, before I go, find a question here. I was wondering, KT, are you familiar with the comedian Maria Bamford?
No.
Really? Oh, you must look her up because she.
Why? Wait.
Well, because she has OCD, and and a lot of her comedy deals with mental health issues, and she is just brilliant.
Oh, that's fascinating.
She has a memoir out too. That's I think the title of it is "Sure, I'll Join Your Cult," which is
It's I've all heard about, of that.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, 12-step groups and things like that. But she has some bits on YouTube you can watch if you just type in Maria Bamford OCD. And she has, you know, talked to OCD groups and things, but really amazing stuff. And
oh, I will look her up. Thank you, Patrick.
She makes it funny. She talks about intrusive thoughts and, you know,
I think we're more aware of neurodivergence than we were, and more accepting of it. There was a long piece in the Wall Street Journal today about new treatments, new therapies and all for dementia and Alzheimer's, which is, you know, you're not necessarily born, you know, neurodivergent, but as you age, you become one. And, you know, and then suddenly you can't trust your own memory or your own body or whatever it is. And, you know, I think we're all becoming more aware.
And the way that trauma can affect your actual body and your brain.
We know about trauma and PTSD, but this is the first time I've thought or have heard that OCD can be a product of trauma. I didn't know that.
A lot of people tuning in from all over the world, actually. Some friends from Australia. Let's see here. Anybody have questions, though?
That's the great thing about Zoom. You know, it actually creates an international community. I love
that. Right. Yeah. Okay. Renee would like to know, is this the first book you actually wrote or the first book that you got published?
It's actually the first book I wrote. I was a magazine editor, as Barbara said, and so I've written a lot of features. I told stories. My day job was in corporate copywriting. I actually named lipstick shades. I worked in cosmetics. I wrote beauty copy. And that was my day job. So this is the first novel I've written.
Have you found that it's separate lobes of the brain operating from nonfiction and fiction?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one reason I got the book done so quickly was because it was an escape from my boring corporate marketing job and a chance to really be creative and write whatever I want. So without having it be approved by various levels of the corporate structure. So it was wonderful.
Let's see. Come on, folks, ask questions.
Well, if you don't have one, I'm going to read something which I think is really fun. It comes at the very end of the acknowledgments. I caution you, always do not read the acknowledgments until you finish the book because there are spoilers in here. But in case you're wondering whether our author has come from a fractured or a bad in her own marriage, here's what she says. Finally, thank you to Alex, I'm assuming Alex is her husband, for over 2 decades of love, adventure, endless patience, and unlimited support, and especially for being my Krav Maga partner. Not all husbands let you kick them in the groin. So there.
I did soften that for the final version of the book. You have an advanced copy where I said, not all husbands risk being kicked in the groin.
Okay.
I felt bad about that.
Well, you, at least you use grain and a groin and not balls, you know? I thought that was a more elegant version of the whole thing.
There are a couple of questions I've found here from YouTube. Brittany would like to know, what scene from the book was your favorite to write? And then the second question is, what are you working on next?
Oh my goodness. Well, I'll take the second question first, which is I'm about 40% through a second book that is also a psychological thriller, character-driven, multicultural story, multi-point of view, multicultural characters, and it may or may not draw on my past experience in beauty and fashion. So that is what I'm working on. And favorite scene to write? I don't know if there's a favorite. I think most cathartic was probably working on the... My favorite character was writing Dr. Patel, the strange, quirky psychiatrist. But it was cathartic to write the scenes of OCD. And when I wrote them, I thought, people who don't have OCD, are they just going to find these scenes funny or not horrific at all? But in reality, afterwards, people find them really horrific, which is interesting to me because I did want to put the reader in the mind of someone with this condition. But when I was writing it, I just thought, is it just going to seem silly to someone else?
No, so, I don't think silly at all. And the book really wouldn't work if she didn't suffer from it. I mean, you would have had a whole different path to working out conflict and conflict resolution and even what crimes might occur.
Yeah.
I mean, her condition is essential to the way this plot works.
Yeah, and I the reason I wrote the book was the way I did was I just read that Stephen King on writing, and he said he was asking himself, what if, and he gave examples in his books, and I thought, I want to write a book, what if, and I was walking my dog, I thought, what if these intrusive thoughts I have, what if they actually manifested themselves in real life? And so that was literally right after I read On Writing, I thought, what if this happened? So the tagline is, if thoughts could kill, and that's the idea behind the book.
Mm-hmm. Very powerful.
Was You Know What You Did your title?
Oh, no. It was actually a much worse, longer title called You Won't Like What You See. And then my editor pulled at Dutton, Lindsay Rose, she's fantastic. She pulled a line from the book, something that the mother says to Annie, you know what you did. And that became the title. And I just wanted to get a chance to send people emails with the subject line, you know what you did, just to freak them out. So I haven't done it yet, but I think it could be fun.
There's some interesting possibilities for titles in the Auden quote that you have in the book. Evil is unspectacular and always human and shares our bed and eats at our own table. That's a really kind of, right? Eats at our own table, I think, is particularly vivid.
Mm. I think that gets to the heart of what I think is really scary horror and thriller, the everyday horror and thriller.
Mm-hmm. Right. There are a lot of the questions or the comments here on, it's interesting, are people kind of weighing in on their own experiences with OCD or knowing people that have OCD and how complex it is.
Yeah.
Let's see. Robin, who Barbara met at Left Coast, she said that, please let her know that there was a great interest in Asian history and influence in books. Naomi was on a panel, and there were some other good panels at Left Coast, right?
Naomi has done wonders in bringing the Japanese American into the wartime experience and so forth into more, familiar form. I think she's done a spectacular job. And we are definitely seeing more, but I think in many ways the Japanese may be more familiar to us than the Thai or the Or the Vietnamese, and I've been to Burma. I mean, I went down, we went on the first open cruise down from Mandalay to, I'm going to use the old words, Mandalay to Rangoon, down, you know, down the Irrawaddy. I can't remember right offhand if there's at least a thriller that's set in Burma. There probably is, and somebody can write in and tell me what it is, because I may have forgotten it. But, you know, there are just so many, you know, what's his name? You know, it's written about Cambodia, Laos. You know who I mean. He's British, but he lives there. And
Colin Cotterill.
Yeah, Colin Cotterill has written some very, but again, you know, he's not actually Laotian or Cambodian. You know, he's even though he writes those characters, they're still, he's not entirely that person. So there's a lot to learn.
Earlier, KT, you were talking about your mother's generation with the French, you know, war in the mid 50s,
and Dien Bien Phu and all that.
It's really interesting because right at the moment I'm reading Graham Greene's The Quiet American, which I'd never read, and wow, it's pretty mesmerizing. You know, the atmosphere he creates in that slim little book.
It was a very violent war.
And it can be said for wars happening now. I think the idea of this violence transcending borders and how it just leads into different countries and it transcends generations. It's just something that I think a lot of people can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That's about it for the questions, really.
All right. Anything you'd like to say closing out here, Miss?
Anything I'd like to say? Well, You Know What You Did comes out tomorrow, and I just am so grateful to you for reading it and selecting it for the first Mystery Club. And I enjoy talking to you, Patrick and Barbara, and I can't wait to see you in person.
Well, we will certainly hope to. And you know what? The gratitude really flows from us to you for giving us this wonderful book. So I do thank you for that. And I hope that all you people in the First Mystery Club will be enlightened from this conversation. We hardly ever get any feedback, do we, Patrick? I mean, they get their books and they read them, but do we get much in the way of saying, you know, great choice, or hated it, or whatever it is you might say?
Not as much as you might think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the rules is they can't send the book back. So, you know, it's not optional. So, you know, but as far as I can tell, you know, many people belong to it for years. As far as I can tell, that is, you know, the point of the experience, really, to sign up for it, is to have this chance to read new voices and experience a variety of books. And you may not know this, but I just happened to get the figures again today, with on average 1,500 new books publishing every single week.
No.
Uh-huh. And 268 new hardcover adult fiction this week. It's very difficult to make any kind of noise or get any kind of visibility. So you are to be congratulated in the amount of recognition that you've gotten. It's not easy.
Is that from New York publishers or just?
No, it's from Edelweiss. No, and they have a pretty wide net. It isn't just New York at all. There's a lot of smaller publishers that are involved. And fortunately, the number of small publishers is growing again, which I think is really, really helpful. A lot of them got sucked up and consolidated into Random House or whatever. But now we're seeing quite a few getting started. And many of them are being distributed by large publishers, but they're not published by large publishers, if you see what I mean. Simon & Schuster is in expanse mode because they have all this money from KKR. And they just decided to start distributing that little Canadian house, ECW, Patrick. They have some really good books, but it's been almost impossible to get them in any, you know. So that can help a lot when a small press has access to the warehouse and distribution system of a bigger group. You know, they can retain their individuality, but they can be easier for bookstores and readers to actually access. So, you know, there's some very good things going on out there in the world. And Dutton was for a long time an independent house, but now it is part of Penguin Random House. And guess what? There's a puppy scratching at the door again. So.
For dinner?
Oh, this is the what's mom doing after dinner stretch. So anyway, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for watching. And I'm heading down to the store to talk to S.J. Roseanne about The Murder of Mr. Ma, which is Judge D, one of my favorite detectives ever from the Tang Dynasty, the 7th through the 9th century China, has miraculously reappeared in 1920s London. So
that sounds fantastic, by the way.
Love it. So I'm going to go down and find out how all that works out. And anyway, that's what's so much fun about all of this is just think of all the places you go. What does the Dr. Seuss thing? You know, the,
got place, it. Oh, the places
the you things go. You'll see. Isn't that it?
Oh, the places you'll go.
Yeah, right. I sort of feel like that, you know, that books are really like a passport or transportation, you know, and you could go, oh, look, you know, all the places that you get to go. It's so wonderful. Anyway, good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.